Canto 1, Chapter 13, Dhritarashtra-kuch Soma, Text Number 18. Vidurastad abhipretya Dhritarashtram abhashata Rajan nirgam yatam shigram Pashyedam bhayam agatam. Vidura, Mahatma Vidura. That abhipretya, knowing it well, Dhritarashtram, unto this rashtra, abhashata, said, Rajan, O king, nirgamyatam, please get out immediately, shigram, without the least delay, pashya, just see, idam, this, bhayam, fear, agatam, already arrived. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Mahatma Vidura knew all this, and therefore he addressed Dhritarashtra, saying, My dear king, please get out of here immediately. Do not delay. Just see how fear has overtaken you. Purport. Cruel death cares for none, be he Dhritarashtra or even Maharaj Yudhishthira. Therefore, spiritual instruction, as was given to old Dhritarashtra, was equally applicable to younger Maharaj Yudhishthira. As a matter of fact, everyone in the royal palace, including the king and his brothers and mother, was rapidly attending the lectures. But it was known to Vidura that his instructions were especially meant for Dhritarashtra, who was too materialistic. The word Rajan is especially addressed to Dhritarashtra significantly. Dhritarashtra was the eldest son of his father, and therefore, according to law, he was to be installed on the throne of Hastinapur. But because he was blind from birth, he was disqualified from his rightful claim. But he could not forget the bereavement, and his disappointment was somewhat compensated after the death of Pandu, his younger brother. His younger brother left behind him some minor children, and Dhritarashtra became the natural guardian of them. But at heart he wanted to become the factual king and hand the kingdom over to his own sons, headed by Duryodhan. With all these imperial ambitions, Dhritarashtra wanted to become a king, and he contrived all sorts of intrigues in consultation with his brother-in-law, Shakuni. But everything failed by the will of the Lord, and at the last stage, even after losing everything, men and money, he wanted to remain as king, being the eldest uncle of Maharaj Yudhishthira. Maharaj Yudhishthira, as a matter of duty, maintained Dhritarashtra in royal honor, and Dhritarashtra was happily passing away his numbered days in the illusion of being a king or the royal uncle of King Yudhishthira. Vidura, as a saint and as the duty-bound affectionate younger brother of Dhritarashtra, wanted to awaken Dhritarashtra from his slumber of disease and old age. Vidura therefore sarcastically addressed Dhritarashtra as the king, which he was actually not. Everyone is the servant of eternal time, and therefore no one can be a king in this material world. King means the person who can order. The celebrated English king wanted to order time and tide. Does anyone know who this celebrated English king is? It's mentioned.
Very old historical personality.
Okay, so he did order. Okay. The celebrated English king wanted to order time and tide, but the time and tide refused to obey his order. Therefore, one is a false king in the material world, and Dhritarashtra was particularly reminded of this false position and of the factual fearful happening which had already approached him at that time. Vidura asked him to get out immediately if he wanted to be saved from the fearful situation which was approaching him fast. He did not ask Maharaj Yudhishthira in that way because he knew that a king like Maharaj Yudhishthira is aware of all the fearful situations of this flimsy world and would take care of himself in due course, even though Vidura might not be present at that time. Om Ajnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Chalakaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya, Prabhu Nityananda, Shri Advaita Gadadha, Shri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So in this section of verses, we are hearing Suta Goswami speak. So he's speaking to the sages herein by Nanashranya about Dhritarashtra's quitting home. So the previous, yesterday's verse is connected to today's verse. And in today's verse, Suta Goswami is describing how Mahatma Vidura, he addressed Dhritarashtra. So in today's verse we are hearing what Dhritarashtra told, what Vidura told Dhritarashtra, which was to, that, oh dear king, please get out of here immediately and see how fear has overtaken you. So in yesterday's verse we heard Suta Goswami was describing that how time overcomes those who are absorbed in family affairs. So today's verse is in connection to that. So knowing that, because Vidura knew that, therefore he's instructing Dhritarashtra to leave home. And we see that is the nature of time. That time is very insurmountable. So insurmountable means something which is very, very great to overcome. So like for example, if you take the ocean is insurmountable. You know, one cannot overcome the ocean. If you are in the ocean, one will be overcome by the tides and the waves. One just can't say, you know, I'll stand there and the waves won't affect me. But the waves actually throw us in the ocean. They move us. Even if it's a low tide, still our body gets moved with the waves. But you can imagine if it's a high tide, then one is just thrown. So insurmountable means something which is very great to overcome, and imperceptible means something which is very hard to perceive, it's impossible to perceive. So that's the nature of time. Time is insurmountable and it's impossible to perceive the effects of time. I mean, one can perceive the effect of time after a great amount of time. So generally we can see after, you know, 5-10 years our body begins to look different. So we can see, yes, time has acted imperceptibly on us. But as in a day-to-day affairs, we cannot see how time is overcoming us. And as we understand from Bhagavad Gita, that the nature of time is that time is eternal. So this time is the energy of Krishna. And time acts differently for in the material and spiritual realms. So in the material world, time has a very destructive effect. You know, Krishna says, time I am, the destroyer of everything. So time destroys everything in this world. There is nothing in this world which is immune to the effects of time. Of course, except for the soul. The soul by nature is eternal. But anything material is not immune from the effects of time. So time will destroy everything. So we can see everything in this world is just degenerating, and the struggle is to keep it fresh. So time takes away that freshness. And time takes away that freshness in relationships, in whatever product we have acquired. After some time it loses its freshness. So time takes away that enjoyment of life, because we really enjoy something if it is very fresh. For example, you can take a flower. If flowers are very fresh, then it has a fresh aroma. And they're very, like, you know, relishable in a sense, the aroma. And no one likes anything stale. So, but we see time takes away all of that. Time destroys all that. And also we see how time carries karma. So the time is the carrier of a karma. So we, all of us have a karma, and time carries that karma and delivers it to us. So time does all these things very imperceptibly. Though we think other people are doing this, or it's caused by such and such, but in effect time is carrying all these things. And the purpose of time is, the main purpose of time is to make us Krishna conscious. And we see the human form of life is most valuable. Of all the 8.4 million species, the human form is most valuable. And the value of time is, the value of time in the human form of life is the most important. Because in even other species there is time, and they are being carried by time. But if they waste their time, you know, it really doesn't matter. Because they don't have the highly developed consciousness to understand the purpose of life. Whereas a human being is complete, because once the human being is complete in the sense that one has a very highly developed consciousness and one can realize Krishna. So if one wastes the human form of life, it's an utter waste of time, because the time in the human form is very limited. We have up to 100 years maximum. And in those 100 years also, we have to devote so much time to bodily activities. You know, like sleeping takes 6-7 hours. A lot of people these days, they sleep 8 to 10 hours or 12 hours. And then, you know, eating, cooking, you know, going to the bathroom, you know, doing some exercise, or in doing your laundry, all these things take a lot of time. So our time is very limited. And Prahlad Maharaj, he also gave an analysis of time, how the conditioned living entity is wasting so much time. If people are watching TV, on Facebook, so much time is going. So our time is very limited, and even if of the limited time, if we waste that, that's a tragedy. That's a real tragedy in the human form of life. So the value of time in the human form is most important. And we also see in the fourth canto, Narad Muni, he was instructing King Prachinna Barishat, because King Prachinna Barishat was very materialistic and he was addicted to fruitive activities. And in order to do fruitive activities, he had killed a lot of animals. So in order to instruct him, he instructed him in an allegorical way, because materialistic persons, if you tell them the philosophy straight away, they cannot appreciate it. You have to tell them through an allegory or story, something they can relate to, someone else like them. So he told them about Puranjana. So Puranjana is, in other words, the body. Is the city represented by the city of 9 gates. So he gave him this allegorical story, and he described that how Chandavega represents time. In the Puranjana allegory, so Chandavega is time, and Chandavega means very swiftly passing away. So that's the nature of time. It's passing away very swiftly. You can ask anyone in this world, especially someone who is in the old age. You can ask them; they'll tell you how life has passed very swiftly. Mm-hmm. That even we can see, you know, in our own lives, where we are 20, 30 years old or 40 years old. These 20, 30 years have passed very quickly. You know, since we have come to Australia or wherever we are from. Even in Krishna consciousness, if you join the temple, time has passed very swiftly. That's the nature of time, Chandavega, that it passes very, very swiftly. And Chandavega, he is accompanied by Gandharvas and Gandharvis. So these Gandharvas and Gandharvis are the 360 days and nights. So the Gandharvas represent the days, and the Gandharvis, they represent the knights. So these are the soldiers of Chandavega, and they are plundering the assets of the body, or they're plundering the body and the products of sense enjoyment. So ignorance means to create products of sense gratification. So we see in today's society is consumer based. So it's producing all these products for sense enjoyment. And the nature of time is Chandravega destroys not only the body but even these objects of sense gratification. And then one is in a way, so the spirit soul is lamenting. And then he describes that, Narad Muni describes that how that the serpent, the five-headed serpent represents the life air, and how the life air, it tries to fight with time, and this is called the struggle for existence. So the struggle for existence means going against the tide of time. So in other words, we have all these spiritual desires to be eternal, full of bliss and full of knowledge, but we are in a material body, so we are limited. And so we are struggling to be eternal, and the life air is represented by the serpent. So the serpent is the protector of the city of Puranjana, which is the Panchala kingdom. So Puranjana was in great anxiety when he saw that his serpent, the five-headed serpent, was in great anxiety, because that serpent was fighting for 50 years. And he was fighting alone against Chandravega and his army, 360 men and women, and his time. And we know time is insurmountable. So he was fighting alone, and in due course of time, the serpent became very weak and he became fatigued. So if you're in a fight and you're alone and you have like three or four, have you ever been in a situation like that? You're getting bashed by three or four people, you're fighting against three or four or maybe more, then one gets fatigued after some time. So the serpent was like that, and then Puranjana was in great anxiety. So we see that that's the nature of time. And Maharaj Dhritarashtra, he was in a similar situation. And the nature of materialistic persons is that they are absorbed in material arrangements, and therefore they cannot see what's happening around them. That's the nature of the mode of passion. So Dhritarashtra's situation was like that. He was absorbed in family affairs. That's what it's mentioned in the previous verse. So absorption means intense focus in some activity. So when someone is absorbed in anything, all their mental powers and energies, they go into that activity. So then one loses focus of what's happening around us. It's like even in photography, if you take a camera and then you can focus it. So when you focus it over a certain point, that's what stands out. And everything else is kind of like blurred off. It's like, it's there, but it's like blurred. So you can't really, one really can't see that. It's not that clear. So in the same way, when one is absorbed in something, that's what one focuses on. So, but because we have come to this material world, and since time immemorial, we are absorbed in material things, because that's the nature of our conditioning. Because we identify with the body, and then we become absorbed in the body and the bodily arrangements. So Dhritarashtra, he was in a situation like that. And this mode of passion, it really intensifies this absorption. That's the nature of the mode of passion. So the mode of passion is characterized by intense hankering, insurmountable desires, lamentation, intense attachment, intense endeavor, intense hankering, and fruitive activities. So these are the characteristics of the mode of passion. And all this leads to greed. So when one is in the mode of passion, and then one cannot see what's happening around one. So there's that verse, Pashyan api na pashyati. Though even one is sufficiently experienced materially, still they cannot see what's happening around them. So this is the nature of material life. Material life means absorption in material things. And when one is absorbed, one cannot understand the problems of life. So the problems of life are, we know, births, deaths, old age and disease. So these are the problems of life. So one cannot see these problems. One is overcome by all other problems except for these big problems. So one is overcome by temporary problems which are related to one's body and material situation. And one is unable to see the real problems. So, and material life is basically, one is shifting miseries. One is not making a solution to any problems. That's the nature of material life. So one thinks in the mode of passion, yes, right now I'm in a miserable situation and I can avoid this by having that. For example, if someone has a small home and they're not happy living in that, they'll think, okay, I want a bigger home, then my life will be comfortable. But what they don't realize is, in order to have a big home, they have to work very hard. So they haven't got rid of the misery. One has just accepted another misery. So it's actually illusion. So one is accepting another misery, one has to work very hard, and then one has a 10-bedroom house, one has to spend so much time cleaning it and maintaining the house. So one really hasn't got rid of the misery. And Bhagavatam gives the example of if one is carrying a burden on the head, a heavy burden, one is simply shifting the burden from the head to the shoulder. So in actuality, the burden hasn't gone away. We have just moved it from the head to the shoulder. So that's what material life is about. One is not really getting rid of the burden. So in the mode of passion, one is coming up with so many plans for enjoyment to counteract the distresses one is experiencing in life. And all what simply it is one is embracing new miseries. And one is thinking, yes, other miseries are gone. But that's what's happening. And the mode of passion is characterized by sex life. And sex life really intensifies this absorption of the conditioned world, of the conditioned soul. So we know sex life is gross and subtle. In the subtle way, for men it can be, okay, one wants a sense of trust. You know, we want to feel trusted by the... Okay, we're not getting it from the same sex, we want it from the opposite sex. So one wants the sense of trust where whatever we are doing is accepted. One wants a sense of acceptance. Yeah, whatever I'm doing is right. Can't be wrong. One wants appreciation. This is profit, adoration and distinction, in other words. One wants a sense of appreciation. Yes, you know, whatever I've done, I want some recognition for that. One wants admiration. You know, similar kind of flavor. One wants approval. You know, and then encouragement. So, this is how the mode of passion works. In whatever activity we are doing, whether it's, you know, giving a talk or sankirtan or, you know, cooking something or anything. So if you're looking for these things, that's symptomatic of the mode of passion. And for women, you know, caring, this feeling of caring, does someone care for me? Understanding, do people understand my emotions? Then one wants a sense of respect. You know, then one wants a sense of devotion. Is the opposite sex fully devoted to my needs? One wants one's feelings to be validated, you know, and then one wants to be reassured. So for men and women, this profit, adoration and distinction works in different ways, but it's the same thing. And Narad Muni, he also describes the situation of Dhritarashtra to King Prachina Bharishat. So in the fourth canto, again in those chapters, he describes what it means to be absorbed in family affairs. And we also heard that in the previous text, Vidura was saying that Sutta Goswami describes the mind of Vidura, that how Dhritarashtra was absorbed in family affairs, therefore he could not see the imperceptible passing away of time. So in the fourth canto, he again gives King Prachina Parishad the analogy of a deer. Maybe you have read this, but I'll read it out. So it's very powerful. Of course, I don't mean to criticize the Grihastha Ashram, but that's just the reality of this material world, and something for everyone to be mindful of. So he says, "My dear king, please search out that deer who is engaged in eating grass in a very nice flower garden along with his wife. That deer is very much attached to his business, and he is enjoying the sweet singing of the bumblebees in his garden." So here the bumblebees represent the children. So the children, the sweet voices of the children. "He is unaware that before him is a tiger." So the tiger represents time, "which is accustomed to living at the cost of another's flesh. Behind the deer is a hunter who is threatening to pierce him with sharp arrows. Thus the deer's death is imminent." So that's the situation of every living entity in this material world, that we are in a very precarious condition. But when one is overcome by the mode of passion, one cannot see the reality. So Narad Muni is trying to shake King Prachina Parishad, because sometimes we have to be shaken in order to become serious in spiritual life. So as Gopamandeshwar was mentioning, even in Srimad Bhagavatam we find a lot of gyan there. So these things are to shake us. Though Srimad Bhagavatam talks about the positive, Krishna and devotional service, but at the same time we have a very strong footing. We have a foot in both the boats, material boat and spiritual boat. So we have to take our foot off the material boat and put both legs in the spiritual boat. So sometimes we have to be shaken in order to loosen our grip of the material world. And then in the next text he describes, "My dear king, woman who is very attractive in the beginning but in the end very disturbing is exactly like the flower, which is attractive in the beginning and detestable at the end. With a woman, the living entity is entangled with lusty desires and he enjoys sex, just as one enjoys the aroma of a flower. He thus enjoys a life of sense gratification from his tongue to his genitals. And in this way, the living entity considers himself very happy in family life." So, in other words, Vidura was, this is what he was telling Dhritarashtra. "United with his wife, he always remains absorbed in such thoughts. He feels great pleasure in hearing the talks of his wife and children, which are like the sweet humming of bumblebees that collect honey from flower to flower. He forgets that before him is time, which is taking away his lifespan with the passing of day and night. He does not see the gradual diminishing of his life, nor does he care about the superintendent of death, who is trying to kill him from behind. Just try to understand this. You are in a precarious position and are threatened from all sides." So then Prabhupada describes in the purport that materialistic life means forgetting one's constitutional position as eternal servant of Krishna. And this forgetfulness is especially enhanced in the Grihastha Ashram. So we see Grihastha Ashram especially enhances this forgetfulness, because coming to the material world means forgetting Krishna. And then when one is overcome by the mode of passion, then there is intense absorption in material arrangements. And the mode of passion is characterized by this householder life. So that means this absorption is very intense, and one needs very intense spiritual practice to break this. Otherwise, one is stuck. And also in the seventh canto, Prahlad Maharaj, he likens materialistic householder life to a deep dark well. Because if one falls in a deep dark well, there is no hope. Griyanda Kupam. Because if you fall in a well and there is no one around, you can yell as much as you want to, because no one will come and save you. So in villages you can find wells are like that. They are covered by grass. So you are walking and then suddenly you go inside. and then you can shout and cry, but no one comes. So that's the nature of materialistic household life. But in spiritual household life, there is hope. If one is Krishna conscious, one has a spiritual master, one is in the association of devotees, so then one can overcome gradually, one can become Krishna conscious. And the whole aim is that at the time of death, that's why in Varnashram Dharma, there is giving up family life at a certain stage in one's life, so that one is not absorbed in family affairs even at the time of death. So in Puranjana's case, we see when he was dying, even as he was dying, he was absorbed in material affairs. He was thinking about his family. Who's going to maintain my wife? Who's going to maintain my kids? Who's going to look after them? And he became a woman in his next life because he was thinking of his wife. So that's why in Varnashram it's recommended that one quits household life. It's not easy, but it's recommended. So one has to be very Krishna conscious in order to do that. It's not very easy because the attachment is very strong. And here we see how King Vidura, he addresses Dhritarashtra sarcastically as a king. Because Dhritarashtra, he wanted to be a king. He was going to become a king, but because he happened to be blind, therefore he could not become a king. So then Pandu was going to become the king, but Pandu died. And then Pandu's sons were going to become the king next. But Dhritarashtra wanted himself to become the king, and later on he wanted Duryodhana to take over the throne. So Prabhupada mentions that a king means someone who can order. So everyone in the material world is falsely thinking they are the king. So king means the lord of material nature. So in other words, everyone is thinking they are a king in material life. So one reason why people go to work is not simply for money. But another reason why people work is because one can get, then one has an influence of control. Because if you are in a position, you have a certain influence of control. Even if you are not the boss, still some people have to report to you, or if they need something from you, they have to approach you. Like for example, sometimes we go to this doctor, Ganapati Pillai, and he has this receptionist, this lady, and she's a control freak. For those who have been there, they know that. You go there and then you can't touch the wall, you know, though it says the wall is freshly painted. It's painted 1 year ago, still the sign is there. And if you touch the wall by mistake, she'll chastise you. And then she'll say, okay, now you have to give your Medicare card. Okay, now you've done that, go and sit there. You cannot stand here. If you just come out of the sitting room, you get chastised. So she has this illusion that she's in control because she can order everyone else. So that's what it means to be the mentality of a king. So if when one is working in this world, one thinks, yes, I'm in control and certain people are under me. So the more the better. But in fact, the reality is that no one can become a king because no one can overcome time and tide. So time overcomes everyone else. So the real king is material nature. And we are simply subordinates. We are pushed around. And here also, Vidura is saying that fear has overtaken Dhritarashtra. He's telling Dhritarashtra that fear has overtaken him. And we see that fear is the very nature of this world. It is said that the conditioned soul does four things: eating, sleeping, fearing and mating. So fear is one of the four activities of a conditioned soul. Eating, sleeping, fearing and mating. And we see how this fear is all pervasive and all encompassing in the material world. In fact, this fear maintains the material world and the illusion of this material world. And this fear is all encompassing. And we can see in society this fear is very, very prominent. And in fact this fear is abused also. So we can see right from childhood, from babyhood to death, one is in the material world, one is in a constant state of fear. And this fear arises, as is mentioned in the 11th canto, because of identifying with the body and the mind. What's that? Bhayam, dvitiya? Abhiveshanas, yeah. So this fear originates because of identifying with the body and mind. So when one, generally fear means one places a lot of value in that thing. When one places a lot of value in something, then naturally one will be fearful of losing that. So because we identify with the body and the mind, we place a lot of value in that. And then one is naturally very fearful of losing that. So fear in the material world means one is always fearing that one's activities will cease or the quality of one's activities will reduce. So one is always in a state of fear. Anyone in this material world is fearful. So as children are also fearful, they are fearful of someone more powerful than them. And as we grow up, we this fear is still there. And we see that material nature by default also imposes a lot of fear. So there is fear of disease, there is fear of old age, and then there is fear of death. So fear of death is represented by Yavanaraj, who is Yamraj. And old age is Jara. So Jara is the sister of Yamraj. So it's described that old age is, the purpose of old age is to instill fear in the conditioned soul. So one becomes serious and one takes to spiritual life. That's the whole idea. But generally, for conditioned soul, it doesn't happen. So the laws of nature impose fear upon the living entity. There's birth, there's death, there's old age and disease. Then there is fear imposed by our own body and mind. Everyone is in a constant state of fear. You know, my body, because the body is very dear to one. So one is thinking, my body is going to break down. Today I have a back problem. Tomorrow I don't know what problem I'll have. So one is constantly in a state of fear. Then the mind is giving people such a hard time. One's thoughts, one's emotions. Then one is fearful of the society, of people. Societal pressures, how people might give me a hard time, they will not understand me properly. Or people will be a great source of disappointment. This is a state of fear. And then one is fearful of natural disturbances. So these things are imposed upon us. So one is in a constant state of fear. And in today's society, fear is even more pervasive. We see there are so many terrorist attacks happening. So people are in a state of fear. You know, 9/11 happened. And then after that, everyone was in a state of fear. And then there are people who take advantage of that fear. So they say, we need to increase our security. So we need to spend more money, the state budget, on security. So, and there are organizations and people who take advantage, who exploit other people's fear. So people have environmental fears these days. Then there is fears of, even in the food we are eating, people are fearful. You know, what I'm eating, is it pure? Is the food pure? Or it's tampered with? It's genetically modified. So people are, in the back of their mind, there is this fear. I can eat meat, but it will give me mad cow disease. So this fear is always there, it's underlying. Or cancer is so pervasive in society, AIDS. So people are fearful. Tomorrow I might get cancer. Or people are fearful of the violence in the neighborhood. So this fear manifests in the form of anxiety. So we see all this anxiety in society. People are very anxious. This is a symptom of fear. Fear manifests as panic attacks, which is even more intense. It manifests as obsessive compulsive disorders. In other words, someone is always doing something again and again. For example, if you're fearful of thieves, then one is always keeping an eye on the door. Is the door locked? Is the door locked? Is the door locked? That's a symptom of fear. Then fear manifests as phobias. Some people are just fearful of water. So for them to swim is very difficult. And then fear also manifests as post-traumatic stress. So we see fear is there, and even in religion there is fear. So fear is misused in this material world. It is abused for selfish purposes. Some people abuse it. But even in religion there is fear. Of course we see spiritual life should not mainly be motivated by fear. It should mainly be motivated by a sense of love and duty. Sometimes religions use fear to motivate their followers. So they'll say, if you don't surrender to God, you go to hell. And of course this fear aspect is also important in spirituality, in religion. But it shouldn't be the main driving force. So as devotees, we should also be fearful. As devotees, we should be fearful of Maya. So Prabhupada said, only difference between me and one of the differences between me and my disciples is my disciples are not afraid of Maya, whereas I am afraid of Maya. So we have to be always in a state of fear. It shouldn't be that all the time we are like this. But we have to be aware of the nature of this material world. And the greatest fear for a devotee is to fall down from the human form of life into a lower species of life. So as a devotee, we should be fearful not to glide down in lower species. So we should always at least get a human form so we can complete a bhakti. And even in Krishna's pastimes, there is fear. So even in the spiritual realm, sometimes there's news like, okay, there's some demon here. Then the devotees are fearful. But that fear leads to more attachment to Krishna. It enhances the pastimes of the Lord. So I'll just leave it here. You have any quick questions? Time's up.
Yes. Remember the name King Canute.
King?
King Canute tried to.
Okay.
Story of the East African Worship tried to order the worship.
Okay. King Canute. Thank you. Anything else? Okay. Shri Prabhupada ki jai. Namaskar. Shri Prabhupada ki jai.